Our next speaker is Dr. Pat McGrath, who spoke yesterday. As a refresher, Dr. McGrath is chief of the Division of General Surgery and Vascular Surgery at the University of Kentucky. He's also professor of surgery there. He has been the medical director of the Cancer Center there, and we'll be talking about the current management of breast cancer. You've heard a little bit about the topic from him already in the panel discussion, but Pat, welcome.
All right, so hopefully I'll be able to fill in a few of the gaps that Dr. Northfeld touched on today. I'm going to try in this talk, you can't cover all of surgical management of breast cancer, but I'm going to try to touch base on a few of these sort of current hot topics and try to answer some of the controversies. So going back to Halstead era, up till the late 70s, the thought process in terms of the way breast cancer spread was that there was a primary lesion that then, in a very stepwise fashion, first went to the nodes, then went to distant sites. And that was really sort of felt to be the biology of breast cancer for, as I said, about 100 years. It was really, there's two trials that I'm going to go over again. These are old trials, but if you understand these two trials, I think you understand really the biology of breast cancer. And the first trial that really changed the thinking in terms of the biology of breast cancer was the B04 trial. This was one of the original NSABP trials that in clinically node-negative patients, it randomized patients from what was the standard of care at that time, which was a radical mastectomy, versus a total mastectomy plus radiation to the nodal basins versus total mastectomy alone. Again, this is somewhat controversial because clearly part of the rationale back in the day was to skeletonize and remove all nodes possible because that would improve your survival. Again, this was prior to use of systemic therapy. As you can see, this is a 15-year slide, but this is out to 25 years plus, and the survival curves are exactly the same. So the more and more extensive surgery really did not provide a survival benefit in this group of patients. There are a few caveats. If a patient did develop an axillary recurrence, if they had just previously received a total mastectomy, then they went on and had clearance of their axilla at that time. Also, if you read closely into the paper, there were several of the patients with a total mastectomy that had several nodes removed. But regardless, this really started the process of the way we thought about breast cancer, away from that sort of stepwise progression to really what is now considered to be the current state, which is breast cancer is a systemic disease. Obviously, we can pick it up really early before it's gotten to that point, but one needs to consider it as a systemic disease and use all the modalities available. So breast cancer can go to lung, liver, bone without going to lymph nodes, okay? So the next trial that's pivotal is what we touched on a little bit earlier as well, which was the B06 trial. And I was a resident during this trial, so I actually have lived through some of these. But this trial randomized over 2,000 patients to either, again, what at that time was a standard of care modified radical mastectomy versus a lumpectomy, axillary dissection, and radiation therapy versus a lumpectomy and axillary dissection alone. The key was that you had to have free surgical margins. We're going to touch base on that a little bit later. And they got radiation therapy at 5,000 centigrade. As you can see, there was no doubt that radiation therapy had a significant improvement on the number of ipsilateral breast tumor recurrences. And, it has obviously become pretty standard of care. Again, if you look at the overall survival, there really isn't a difference in overall survival, even if you had a recurrence after having a lumpectomy alone. Because again, the caveat in the trial was that if you got a recurrence, the patients would go on and at that point receive a mastectomy. So again, it helps you understand a little bit of the biology of breast cancer and the way we should properly be managing it. Now, if you looked at some of their early data in terms of ipsilateral breast tumor recurrences, this is really in an era without much systemic therapy. So at 20 years, Fisher had a 14%. Veronese, that took out the entire quadrant, had only an 8% local recurrence rate. Of note, in all of these trials, what they found out was that the incidence of recurrence in node-positive women receiving adjuvant chemotherapy was half the local recurrence in the counterparts that did not receive systemic therapy. So this also pointed out to us that, in fact, systemic therapy was probably providing some degree of local control. And that's going to be important as we move on because, really, nowadays, most patients are getting adjuvant systemic therapy. We also have way more refined mammographic and pathologic evaluation. So now in major centers doing lots of breast surgery, and you know, in your own practice should be looking at local recurrence rate, it should be in the range of 5% or less. And this is what I tell patients. I followed patients for 25 years. I've seen patients recur 20 years later. They're usually hormone receptor positive tumors. They're these indolent tumors. I can't even explain why they recur. Actually, a lot of them are probably new primaries. But regardless, it's still, you can count those cases on one hand. So these are very few and far between. Breast conservation surgery is applicable probably in about 80% of patients. If you look at some of the big national trials that we've participated in over the years, probably, and these are with, you know, centers that are really advocating breast conservation, probably about 60% of patients undergo breast conservation surgery. That number is starting to decline, and I'll get into that a little bit. Local recurrence rates, again, should be 5% or less. There's no question, as was pointed out by Dr. Northfelt this morning, borderline cases can be downstaged with neoadjuvant therapy. And if there's any question that I would end up with a poor cosmetic result during breast conservation surgery because the tumor was a little too large and the patient was definitely going to require adjuvant chemotherapy, I will downstage them with neoadjuvant therapy and allow for probably a better cosmetic and surgical result. The other thing, and I think it was brought up by our panelists this morning, is informed patient decision. When I first embarked on this whole thing, there was a lot of literature pointing out surgeon bias. And early on with breast conservation, there was huge surgeon bias in that they didn't really think that was as good as a mastectomy. And there were data showing that the surgeon was sort of the one dictating that. It's important to lay out objectively to the patient exactly what the numbers are, what their chances of recurrence, what the treatment involves, and let them make the decision. But they have to be informed to be able to make that decision. Some of the few little caveats. I am amazed at the number of improper incisions I still see. The original workshops from the NSABP pointed out the incisions, and they're the same to this date, which is basically follow the pattern of the areola and then make those incisions accordingly. The role of radial incisions are few and far between. Sometimes they can be done in the lower quadrants, inferiorly at 6 o'clock, more of a mastopexy type incision. But for the most part, curvilinear incisions are the answer. We never close the dead space. You want that to fill in with the seroma. That provides the contour of the breast to be pretty normal. And if you know you're doing a complete axillary dissection, this is a little different with sentinel nodes, but if you know you're doing a complete axillary dissection, keep your lumpectomy and your axillary dissection compartments separate. The reason being, you're going to put a drain in. It's going to end up sucking down the lumpectomy, and they end up with a poor cosmetic result. Now with the day of sentinel nodes, and I'll talk to you a little bit about how we're doing some of that, if you, in fact, have a lesion in the axillary tail, you know you're not going to do an axillary dissection, then it's not unreasonable to attack both through the same incision. Meticulous hemostasis is one thing over the years I've become particular about, because if you get a hematoma, it really ends up hurting your cosmetic outcome. Okay, so over the years, there have been a million reasons not to do breast conservation. Breast too large, breast too small. I showed you yesterday some slides of very large breasts that had a great result with combined reduction mammoplasty at the time of a lumpectomy. Breast too small, it's all relative. If, in fact, it's going to end up with a real significant cosmetic defect, you know, then you have to take that in consideration. Age has no effect on it. Poor cosmetic results, you know, when you do enough breast conservation, do it properly, you'll see that that would be better than most reconstructions any day. Tumor too close to the nipple, if it's actually involving the nipple, that's one thing. But if it's close to the nipple, you can raise the nipple as a flap and lay it down. It works out pretty well. There are some early papers talking about extensive intraductal component. That all now has been put to rest. As long as you get clear surgical margins, that's the answer. Aggressive histology, triple negative tumors actually do better if they receive radiation. They have a lower local recurrence rate. So breast conservation for triple negatives is actually, I think, beneficial. Really the one thing I want to focus on for a second, and where I see most patients coming for a second opinion, saying that their surgeon said they had to have a mastectomy, was they done a lumpectomy and they got a positive margin. Now they need to have a mastectomy, or their margin was close. So there's been a lot of debate recently about margins, and I think it's hopefully being put to rest now. Remember that your goal with a margin in lumpectomy is to remove the primary tumor with negative margin while preserving the shape and size of the breast for an optimal cosmetic outcome. Now, NSABP, through all these years that I grew up with it, a negative margin was no ink on tumor. And they stood with that, and their recurrence rates are no different than a lot of the series that talked about the, you know, that kind of sweated over what a margin was. And so finally, SSO and ASTRO got together and came out with a consensus statement. This has been endorsed by ASCO as well. And the bottom line is they went through 33 studies that showed, you know, where the definition they used was no ink on tumor as a negative margin. And what they found out, first of all, was that if you did have a positive margin, there was a twofold increase of ipsilateral breast tumor recurrence. On the other hand, if you had no ink on tumor negative margin, there was no benefit from wider excisions on IBTR. So there's a lot of question about, well, the tumor, the margin's only a millimeter, or it's less than a millimeter. You know, do I need to re-excise? And the answer is, unless you have ink on tumor, you do not. Now, you know, there are some reasons to reconsider re-excision, and I will tell you that I would think it's beneficial to sit down with the pathologist and look at the slides. You know, again, we have benefit of doing that in a multidisciplinary breast conference, but when you sit and talk to the pathologist specifically about the margins and look at the pattern of the tumor, you get a feel with which ones you need to go back and do some re-excision. Obviously, if you have tumor at the inked margin, if there is a huge discrepancy or a discordance between your radiologic and pathologic tumor size and you have multiple closed margins, you might have to rethink whether or not you, in fact, have a proper specimen. If you have a pattern of really what I would describe probably as a multifocal process, again, you have to sort of take that into consideration. A lot of these patients, their imaging is so good now that you have an idea of that ahead of time, so this is becoming less and less of a factor. The one I have the hardest time with is cautery artifact. And, when you're working with residents, there's no question that, you know, part of your whole goal with the lumpectomy is you're just trying to not mangle the specimen, and you're trying to make sure that, you know, when they're with the bovie, that they're not jabbing the specimen with the bovie, because they'll say, well, you've got, you know, tumor near a cauterized margin. Well, you know, sometimes that's inadvertent, them sticking the bovie down into the actual specimen. So, again, you have to look at your entire margin and see if that cautery is actually in a crevice and does not reflect a true margin. So the real contraindications of breast conservation is if the tumor is too large, and again, you would like to consider neoadjuvant therapy in some of those patients. If a patient's had prior radiation therapy, now I've had some radiation oncologists say that they can re-radiate. I've seen nothing but misery from that. I don't think it's a good, that's just my personal experience. So we tend not to re-radiate. And if there are some contraindications to radiation therapy as well. If the patient has two or more cancer in separate quadrants, now we can have contiguous lesions or two lesions that are, you know, within a centimeter of each other, and we have successfully done breast conservation in those settings. And then the other thing is diffuse malignant appearing calcifications. And you should be able to determine that up front and not even really broach breast conservation in those settings. So that kind of leads us to what is probably a new trend, not only for the increased use of mastectomies, but also the increasing use and trend for contralateral prophylactic mastectomies. Just some background. If you look at the incidence of contralateral breast cancer in all patients that would come into your office with a diagnosis of breast cancer, and NSABP has great data on this because it's gone over years and years and years, it's roughly 1% per year. Now, if those tumors are hormone receptor positive, and the patient actually goes on to receive their 5 years of adjuvant therapy, endocrine therapy, that reduces the risk of a contralateral breast cancer by half. So those patients with hormone receptor positive tumors, their risk of a contralateral breast cancer is about 5% at 10 years. If you talk to patients that come in and want a bilateral mastectomy, they think their risk is in excess of 50% for the most part. If you look at, and the other thing too, is these patients are a captive audience. Usually, even in the more rural settings, I mean, early on I did a mammographic study and we had a 95% follow-up rate at 5 years. These patients come back and see you and they rarely fall through the cracks. So they're gonna get close follow-up, and a second primary tumor in the contralateral breast is usually picked up at stage one or DCIS stage. The incidence of contralateral prophylactic mastectomy was about 6% in 1999. In 2007, it's 16%, and I think it's probably heading towards 20% now. You know, back then, it was obvious that younger, educated patients that had a family history of breast cancer were more interested in that. But the early studies all showed, if you took all comers, no improvement in survival. There was one SEER database study from 1998 to 2003 that looked at patients that had had contralateral prophylactic mastectomies. And in a very small subset of patients that were young with very early stage hormone receptor negative tumors, they did see a 5-year survival benefit, 83 to 88%. But by and large, all the recent studies that are now looking back at this issue have not found a survival benefit for a prophylactic mastectomy. And that's obviously, we're talking about patients that are not have a BRCA gene mutation. So contralateral prophylactic mastectomies, no question, will reduce the risk of developing contralateral breast cancer. The question is, what is that real risk? It does not improve disease-specific survival, but what nobody talks about too much is actually it does have, as you would imagine, twice the risk of complications. Recent studies have gone through this ad nauseum, looking at factors associated with patients pursuing contralateral, and again, it's younger patients. Caucasian stood out as a predictor, private insurance, family history of breast cancer, lobular histology, because it will carry a increased risk, maybe 1.5% per year risk in the contralateral breast, their ability to get immediate reconstruction. But the one that I've found that has stood out a lot is patients getting MRIs. And again, this becomes an issue too, and it was curious to see one of our panelists bring it up, right? Because they were thinking they were getting inferior care because they weren't getting an MRI, and, you know, for their follow-up, much less for their immediate analysis. It started out when MRI came, we were all in, and virtually every patient that we saw got an MRI. We've become more selective now because we found out a lot of stuff. One of the early, and you know, the role of MRI in breast imaging, it's very helpful in determining extent of disease. There's no question. And you can determine, when you look at your mammogram, which patients are going to probably you could get fooled on. And those are patients with really extremely dense breast tissue. Or yesterday, the pregnant patient I talked about, when you looked at her plain imaging with mammography, you got the sense that there was this was going to be a multifocal process. And so to be 100% sure and to help the patient with the decision-making, that'd be a great case to do an MRI in. But if you have a 65-year-old fatty breast with a 1-centimeter spiculated mass that is without other areas of concern, those patients don't need MRIs. You know, it's obviously been helpful in a high-risk group of patients, even the BRCA gene mutation patients, for screening. And you can do MRI-guided biopsies. The question that comes out and has been borne out in studies, is it too sensitive? Are there too many false positives? So one of the early studies looked at this out of Penn, and they looked at 267 patients, and there are no question. The MRI sensitivity was 95%+. You know, it altered the surgery in about a quarter of the patients. The question was, did that surgery plan need to be altered? So, you know, what they found when they went back and looked at pathologic verification is that there was really only a 71% specificity, which isn't very good. So you get a lot of false positives that you got to be a little careful with. Again, this is an early study, and there have been things that have been learned with MRI. But what I have found is that, unfortunately, once you start down that path requiring a possible repeat biopsy, most patients at that point say, I want a mastectomy. So, you know, if you have a MRI abnormality that they do a second look ultrasound, they can't see it by there, they're going to have to set up an MRI-guided biopsy to prove that, in fact, the patient is a good candidate for breast conservation. Quite often, they will go ahead and just want a mastectomy. So we're cognizant of this, and so we really use MRI, I think, in a more thoughtful fashion now. I'm going to move on now to, again, probably the most controversial area in management of breast cancer, and that's the role of axillary node dissection. And you already have seen, when we went back to the original Halstedian concept and to where we are now, there's been a huge shift in terms of what the nodes are about. But go back to B04. It still showed that nodes were, in fact, for staging and to help you determine, you know, the prognosis of the patient and what additional therapy. And this is for clinically node negative. Nobody argues about, you know, if patient has gross disease in the axilla, what to do. It's still, you know, early on, there's no question. It was our most powerful prognostic indicator. Now we have, you know, gene arrays that are able to tell us probably more specifically, not anatomically, but biologically, what the prognosis of this patient's going to be. So very well, the concept of axillary nodes as a strong prognostic indicator may take a back seat to these other studies. And there is no question that historically, level 1 and 2 axillary node dissection gave us great staging. It was associated with less than a 3% rate of axillary recurrence, and this was prior to doing chest wall radiation and axillary radiation. But the morbidity was significant. I mean, anybody that followed patients long enough know that it was 20 to 30% lymphedema, and if they say, oh, not in my practice, they were lying. So that's when sentinel node came along, and I know you all know about that, and so we're not going to belabor that too much. The technique, there are some newer products out there. Previously, it was technetium sulfur colloid. Now, more and more are using LymphoSeq. And these are intradermal injections. I did blue dye once and said I'd never do it again. There are data showing that there is a maybe percentage point better detection, but I just found it too messy, and I didn't think that I needed it. In your practice, if it's something that works for you, that's fine, because it's another way to identify the sentinel nodes. And the combination is theoretically a percentage point better. And obviously the successful sentinel node procedure, and when early on when we were doing this, we had to do the sentinel node and then do the axillary section and make sure we didn't have false negatives. You know, the timing of injection is an interesting thing. When we were using the sulfur colloid particles, I basically did it right before they took the patient back to the operating room. By the time they prepped and draped, we were good to go. With Lymphoseek, I found that they actually had to go a little bit longer. The other thing that we'll talk about is failures, and there are certain subgroup of patients that you might want to give a little bit longer to allow the mapping to occur. And this is, I'm sure Marty knows this, this is a favored board question. They ask people, what do you do when the sentinel node doesn't uptake? And I tell the residents one thing in there, and they know that's not the board answer, because when you do a lot of sentinel nodes, number one, you realize it's always in the same location. So if I don't get uptake and I know the location, I'll tend to do really good palpation, but I'll probably do a limited axillary dissection, taking the nodes that I know are going to be involved. But the board answer may be to do more complete node dissection. Patients that are elderly, that have real fatty nodes, those are a problem. Previous breast radiation, that's a problem too. There was a question about preoperative chemotherapy and its effect on the uptake of the mapping for sentinel nodes. And the data is pretty clear. It's still in the 90%+ range, 92%. So getting neoadjuvant chemotherapy does not preclude a very successful sentinel lymph node mapping and biopsy. So, you know, the current data shows it's the standard of care. It'll identify 93% to 99% of sentinel nodes. The false negative rate is pretty established between 5% and 10%. And that's where I will also say I've had cases where you felt a 4-millimeter firm node that ended up being the sentinel node. It was completely replaced with tumor. It didn't take up any of the tracer. So, you know, if you don't get good uptake, or if it's marginal, really make sure you do good palpation and try to feel all the nodes and see if there's any clinically positive ones. And you know, I would have sent those off. Obviously, if sentinel node was negative, there was no further axillary node dissection. So what happens, though, when your lymph node came back positive? The standard had been a complete axillary node dissection, right? And, you know, when they were starting to think about the possibility of whether you needed an axillary node dissection, it became apparent that there were people out there not doing complete axillary node dissections in patients with a positive sentinel node. SEER data from 1998 to 2004, they found that 16% of the patients didn't have completion axillary node dissection, and that patients that had micrometastasis, 38% didn't need it. And those patients didn't seem to suffer. So, you know, that along with stuff that I was talking about in our own center, we knew that we could really narrow down the extent of our axillary node dissection and still get the same information. So that's where the Z11 trial came in. And yesterday I talked to you about some of the concerns with that trial, the fact that it closed early, it didn't meet the total number of accrual. But still, you have an over 800 patient randomized trial looking at axillary sentinel node. And if it's positive, either going on to get a complete axillary dissection as standard of care or to get followed, incorporating those lower axillas with the radiation. So, you know, there are faults with the study, but you're not going to get a better, you know, sort of volume in a randomization that's going to show huge survival differences. And if you just focus on local recurrence, which really is the answer, it's really no difference. So we know that you probably don't need to be taking out those 15 other negative nodes if you have one positive sentinel node. The other thing, too, is if you're able to really do a good preoperative assessment of the nodes with axillary ultrasound, that really helps you identify that group of patients that, you know, if they do have a positive sentinel node, that may be the only node in their axilla that's positive. So, again, I went through all this yesterday. No difference in the in-breast recurrence, nodal recurrence, overall survival, or disease-free survival. And that's the take-home message. Now, there were a couple other trials that EROTC had a trial, again, looking at completion axillary node dissection in sentinel node-positive patients versus axillary radiation. and they show no difference in axillary recurrences. Same with micromets. There's a trial looking at axillary node dissection versus no axillary node dissection with patients with micromets and showed no difference. So how has this affected our practice, your practice? You know, I think that comes down to what you're comfortable with and what your institution's comfortable with, what your medical oncologist is comfortable with, and you have to talk to them about this. There was actually a report out of MD Anderson, and I think this kind of typifies what I'm doing now, too. So since Z11 was published, the MD Anderson looked at their experience, and the number of axillary node dissections with a positive sentinel node dropped from 85% to 24%. The number of intraoperative frozen sections has dropped from 69 to 26, and the operative time, which is an important thing this day and age, it dropped from 92 to 79 minutes. So my current practice, and again, this is something that we all had to agree to in our group, and in terms of the multimodality management of these patients, is that I now, as I started with the sentinel node, sent that off, and while I was doing that, would do my lumpectomy. I, for patients getting breast conservation, I now start with the lumpectomy and do whatever analysis I'm going to do on that, and then I do a sentinel node, and I send it for permanent. What I do differently, not too much with the sentinel node, other than I make sure that I really seek and find every node that has tracer, you know, uptake that's 10% or more, and include that in the permanent specimen. If a patient comes back with permanent specimen positive node, that's taken into consideration by the radiation oncologist. And this just goes on to then the next question, which is there a role for sentinel node mapping and biopsy in patients that you know up front have clinically positive nodes, right? So the this was the ACOSOG Z1071 trial. And this is, again, patients that were known to have positive nodes. They underwent neoadjuvant chemotherapy. These patients then went on to have whatever operative procedure they were going to have, their lumpectomy, and they did a sentinel node dissection with, they used dual tracer was their encouraged technique. And then these patients went on to a completion axillary dissection. So this was sort of a feasibility study to determine in patients that you knew had positive nodes going into neoadjuvant therapy. Now they're post-neoadjuvant therapy. You take them to the operating room. They did their sentinel node, took that out, then did their completion axillary dissection, and then they see whether, in fact, it was reliable, whether the sentinel node was, in fact, reliable. So they were able to identify 92.5% of the sentinel nodes. Their caveat is if they incorporated at least two sentinel nodes, then their false negative rate was 12.8%. If they only had one sentinel node, it was as high as 20% false negative. The Setna study sort of showed a similar thing, this was people that had a sentinel node removed surgically and then tried to do another sentinel node after neoadjuvant therapy. They had a very poor success rate of only 60%, and their false negative rate in FNA-confirmed positive nodes was only 19%. Again, I've gone through the benefits of axillary ultrasound. This we utilize for the most part in patients that have either tumors that are greater than 1.5 centimeters or tumor with unfavorable characteristics, if they're triple negative, poorly differentiated, et cetera. If the ultrasound showed an abnormal node, we proceed with FNA and then acted accordingly. So now we're going to just switch gears on another area that I think, again, seems to prompt a lot of questions. DCIS. So again, this seems to be an area that patients seem to be quite concerned about, a lot of the referring physicians are concerned about. It's a process that is 98 to 99% curable. The incidence has significantly increased over the last 25 years due to early detection with mammography. It accounts for 30 to 50% in women under 50 detected by screening alone, and 15 to 25% in women over 50. The median age for women with DCIS is 45-65. The risk, again, of breast cancer death is extremely low. And all the previous studies showed that probably the invasive component was missed at the time. You know, if you look back historically, it took a long time for surgeons to get on board with the use of breast conservation for patients with DCIS. Back in 91, the National Cancer Database showed that 42% of the patients were getting modified radical mastectomy. So they were willing to do lumpectomy in invasive cancer, but DCIS, the feeling was it was diffuse, it needed a mastectomy. It took a while till that, you know, was changed. And there were numerous studies showing that there was no difference in recurrence, local recurrence, whether the tumor was invasive or non-invasive. B17 was a very good study by NSABP with DCIS, 818 patients. And here they looked at lumpectomy versus lumpectomy plus radiation. There was a lot of argument back then that they needed to include mastectomy as part of the randomization, and fortunately they didn't do that. But the margins had to be free. There, again, when they followed out, their ipsilateral breast tumor recurrence was significantly lowered with the addition of radiation. Distant recurrence stays stable through all these years, which is 1%. And again, it's because an invasive component was missed. The majority of recurrences are DCIS. They'll occur anywhere 4, 5, 6 years. But obviously, you follow a patient long enough with DCIS, they can get a new primary in their breast 15 years down the road. The only factor associated with recurrence has been comedonal necrosis or positive margins. Following up on this, B24 started questioning the benefit of tamoxifen in patients with DCIS. Once we knew that it had was beneficial in patients for prevention. So this trial could have been really good if everybody sort of paid attention to the actual recommendations. There were 1,800 patients eligible treated by lumpectomy and radiation, randomized to placebo plus tamoxifen. One of the things they wanted to do with this trial was determine, did positive margins for DCIS really matter? So they allowed positive margins in this trial. Or if patients had some scattered calcifications that could have been DCIS, they allowed those in the trial as well. Unfortunately, they left it up to the surgeon. And I was one of those surgeons that if you got a positive margin, you sort of tended to go back and re-excise. And so it's hard to get rid of your biases, and so any good trial shouldn't leave it up to the surgeon, I don't think, because you're going to introduce bias. So that's what the difference was, but clearly tamoxifen benefited these patients in terms of local recurrence without a question. And most of the benefit came in terms of reducing the number of patients with an invasive component. So if you did recur and you were on tamoxifen after breast conservation with DCIS, the majority overwhelmingly were DCIS. So, you know, again, lumpectomy, radiation therapy, tamoxifen, very effective in prevention of invasive cancer. You know, the if you pulled out only the 23% of the patients that had positive margins and looked at that subset, what you found out is that if you added tamoxifen to that subset of patients, it gave them the same local recurrence rates as a negative margin in patients that didn't receive tamoxifen. So tamoxifen was very beneficial in terms of reducing local recurrence. And it's also one of those things that when you look at margins, sort of have to, you know, take all of it into consideration. If the patient's strongly hormone receptor positive, they have a focus of DCIS at the margin, it's not the end of the world to leave that sit tight as long as everybody's on the same page. The patient's going to go on tamoxifen. Their chance of local recurrence is going to remain very low. So risk of dying from breast cancer with breast conservation for DCIS is 1 to 2%. But you do need commitment. The patient's got to get followed up closely. So those patients that do require mastectomy, it's because of the extent of the disease. If it's a true multicentric diffuse process, if you really are unable to clear margins, and if it's the patient's preference, if that's what they desire. And so if they do desire that, these are excellent candidates for immediate reconstruction. And I'm not going to go over, because time's short, about all the reconstructive options. But they're numerous. These are patients that you need to have talk with the plastic surgeon about options. You know, we've shown that skin-sparing mastectomies are oncologically sound. They're very good candidates for this. If you do a mastectomy for DCIS also, you should be doing a sentinel node so you don't get burned by having an invasive component in the breast. But this is basically shows some of the reconstructions we're able to do with a skin-sparing mastectomy. Early on in my career, and this is a tram flap, but early on I would often make a little lateral extension, and you can see that a little bit better up here. There's the tram flap incision. Over time, I quit doing that. This was actually a kidney transplant patient. I throw this up because they had very little scarring because of the steroids, which was helpful. They needed a better tattoo. But that brings us into nipple-sparing mastectomy. And what I'll say is that it's an extension of the concept of skin-sparing. Skin-sparing studies clearly have shown oncologic safety. Nipple sparing is now showing oncologic safety, but there's some rules, and you can't do it in everybody. This is a patient that actually did prophylactically, but this is a patient that had an early breast cancer. They get great cosmetic results, especially when you have a plastic surgeon that's used to reconstructing nipple sparing mastectomies. I prefer, there's a lot of different incisions. I actually prefer an infrareolar, and this will extend up as far as I need to be able to get to the axilla from my sentinel node. So these are usually good for small tumors, not centrally located. They're very good for prophylactic mastectomies, including BRCA gene mutations. Early on, there are a lot of studies looking at occult nipple involvement. This would be seen more frequently in patients with poorly differentiated, greater than 2 centimeters. They're centrally located. Multicentric tumors or significant lymphvascular invasion and nodal involvement. So out of that has come some practical exclusions. If a patient has just really diffuse DCIS, probably not the best candidate. If they've had a history of radiation, not the best candidate. Multicentric tumors. And then if they're just too close to the areola and base of nipple, it's not a good candidate. Still nodal involvement ends up being of concern, and post-mastectomy radiation is of concern too. And there was a recent report showing that more patients were getting post-mastectomy radiation with nipple sparing that probably didn't need it because of concern for possible tumor being left behind. The relative contraindications, and these are real because these really affect your outcome. Smoking, diabetes, and if you have significantly ptotic breasts, and you know BMI greater than 25. So I'm going to leave it at that. I will say that this has been very enjoyable. You have a great symposium you would be proud of. I was telling Steve and others that we sort of had something like this in Lexington years ago, and it fell by the wayside. 43 years of a symposium like this is admirable, and Dr. Kuntz, I know in the back, was responsible for a lot of that, but it's a good thing. I hope you keep it going. I'm not going to be able to be here for answers or questions and answers. Dr. Grant's an expert. He could probably answer most of these, I think. But, yeah, if there's any burning thing right now, I'm happy to try to answer, but otherwise, if you need to move on, we can.
Good.
Thank you, Pat. That was excellent. Dr. McGrath will be available in the back of the room for a little bit yet. If you have questions, go ahead and ask him.